supports inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a rebroadcast interview with mental health recovery advocate Sarah Lay. But first, disability news for the week of December 25th, 2023. The 2021 Federal Medical Expenditure Panel Survey published a new study recently in the Disability and Health Journal, which examined the experiences of more than 22,000 people across the country about their experiences with the healthcare system. Results showed that people with cognitive disabilities were much less satisfied with their healthcare services and had inferior and more negative experiences with their doctors. The biggest issues were provider communication, both in listening and explaining to their patients, as well as spending less time with patients with disabilities, according to the study. While previous studies have examined across access to healthcare or the perspectives of medical providers, researchers at Rutgers University said their findings are some of the first to evaluate opinions of people with disabilities. Researchers say that communication problems described by people with disabilities could lead to negative outcomes. Elizabeth Stone, a Rutgers University researcher who led the study, said, quote, "Addressing this problem might include incorporating disability competencies into medical education and should also include policies, for example, enhanced reimbursement, that reflect the increased time and effort that might be needed to ensure that the needs of people of disabled patients are being met," end quote. Also, researchers noted that adults with intellectual disabilities should do more preparation than communicating with their healthcare providers, such as asking for accommodations that could improve their experience. Other research has shown that many doctors are not prepared to provide care for people with disabilities in the same way as others. As a result of the challenges, the National Institute of Health designated people with disabilities as a health disparity population in September. In recent years, disability advocates have pressed for a requirement that all medical schools provide detailed training on treating people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but to date, that effort has not been successful. The American Medical Association and the American Dental Association did finally commit to working on expanding disability training for medical and dental students just last year. Courthouses in Illinois will be required to have staff available for people with disabilities beginning in 2024. The Illinois Supreme Court is already making changes to several policies on accessibility starting on January 1st. The changes will require courts to have a designated court disability coordinator in addition to providing contact information for the coordinator on signs and request forms. The changes are intended to allow people with disabilities to avoid confusion and inconsistency between courthouses. According to Supreme Court Access to Justice Commission Chair George Ortiz, quote, "Ensuring disability access within our courts is not just a legal obligation, but a commitment to access to justice," end quote. Other changes clarify the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Illinois Human Rights Act, the responsibilities of courts, and rights of court users who have disabilities. Changes also include updating the definition of a disability and other language changes. And finally, speech recognition software hasn't worked very well for people who could really use it, like people with disabilities who have communication challenges. Researchers at the University of Illinois have a possible solution. Instead of only training artificial intelligence with people who have perfect diction, they are expanding the database to include people with speech affected by various conditions. Mark Hasegawa Johnson is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the university. He said, quote, "Usually what we find is that people who might have have difficulty being understood in some situations will be understood just fine by people who know them well. We know that it's possible to communicate with speech. It's just a matter of getting the device accustomed to your voice, end quote. Speech recognition is used by commonly used in programs like Alexa, Siri, and speech-to-text in cell phones, as well as other technology, though it isn't rare for the software to make mistakes, but the error rate is much higher for people with Parkinson's, for example. Hasegawa Johnson said, quote, if the automatic speech recognizer is expecting the person to sound like an audiobook narrator, and instead it's listening to somebody with Parkinson's, it gets almost a 20% error rate. When we train it using the speech of other people with Parkinson's, the error rate goes down to about 10%, end quote. When Hasegawa Johnson started at the university in 1999, he contacted Adrian Perlman, head of the Department of Speech and Hearing Science, to start a project for developing speech recognition for people with cerebral palsy. They recorded 18 Urbana area residents and created a small database. At that time, it was used briefly by a doctoral student and then went unused after the student graduated. Starting in 2010, that small database became important to projects across the world, as different labs used it for their own projects with speech recognition software. As a result, the error rate has dropped from 70% to 20% over the last 15 years. According to Hasegawa Johnson, quote, it's still an order of magnitude worse than the error rates that are being produced by commercial speech recognizers. The reason for that is that there are only 16 people in that database, and commercial speech recognizers are trained on thousands, end quote. So the Speech Accessibility Project is now getting as many people with Parkinson's, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, or ALS who have a speech disability due to a stroke to record themselves speaking. Marie Moore Channel and Lori Maddy, both associate professors of speech and hearing science, who had been involved in research with people with Down syndrome, became involved more recently. Both said they're excited to work for this project to increase accessibility and inclusion for the people they've been working with for so long. Due to state data privacy laws, however, Illinois residents cannot participate in the project, as laws limit the use of their data to 3 years, and researchers want the database to last indefinitely. But people from most other states are welcome to participate. Amazon, Apple, Google, Meta, and Microsoft are all supporting the Speech Accessibility Project at the U of I, so they'll get access to the database for the first 6 months after completion. After that, it will become more widely available. Researchers hope the research could lead to new smart home technology that would help people with disabilities be more independent. And that's the news for this week. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today with my guest on the phone, Sarah Lay. And Sarah is actually pretty local. She is from Decatur, Illinois. Sarah is a mental health recovery advocate, and she's going to share a little bit about her own experience today, and I'm sure give us lots of opinions of how our society currently treats people with mental health challenges. So welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hello.
Hello. So introduce the listeners to yourself. Tell us a little bit about you.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to be on the show today. I have not exactly the most experience with having a mental health disability, but I do have some experience with it. I've experienced anxiety and depression a majority of my life, and I've seen firsthand like how harmful stigma can be to people. Whenever I was 8 years old, my mother passed away due to breast cancer, and my father was an ever absent presence in my life.
Mm.
So I didn't really have the best, like, family upbringing or role models. I ended up, my mom had stated in her will that she wanted me to grow up with her brother and his wife. So I lived with them for a little while, but I was a very odd child. I didn't really understand death. I didn't understand how to really, like, wrap my head around it.
How old were you when your mom passed away?
I was 8 years old.
Yeah, very, very young for something like that.
Yes. And so I think as one of my defense mechanisms, I just repressed all feelings.
Mm.
I was very isolated and didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't want to be around people. My aunt and uncle didn't really understand how to deal with me, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I started going to counseling probably about age 9 or 10. And it was weird because at that time I had a lot of anger. So I would take it out on, like, the counselors, and I would say, I hate counselors. And as I started to get older and started to process things, I had a lot of difficulty with loneliness and not understanding why I had to be the one to not have, like, parents. I felt very orphaned. I felt like I couldn't really relate to anybody.
Mm-hmm. So you moved in with your aunt and uncle, and your father actually wasn't around after that, after your mom died?
Yeah, he wasn't. He knew she had breast cancer, and he decided to move to Florida. And then he tried to gain custody of me, which I thought was not very smart on his part because he was the one who left. But I'm very thankful that he didn't get custody, because I do not think I'd be in the position I am today. I think I would not be in a good place had I lived with him.
So are you an only child?
Yes.
And so you truly were alone. Had you been close to your aunt and uncle before that?
No. I'd only spent a couple weekends with them.
Wow. So really a devastating situation. It's certainly understandable how angry you must have been as a child, and how depression could essentially take over your life. Is that how you would describe it?
Yes, I would. And it really surfaced when I was in high school. I had decided that since I didn't really connect with my aunt and uncle, I asked my grandmother, with my mom's mom, if I could live with her. So I changed schools once again.
Mm-hmm.
And switching, it was like my third school at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in sixth grade. So from all the moving, I never really had a chance to build, like, those relationships that are really important at that time in your life.
Yeah, I can certainly hear that. And not only that, but if you are struggling with depression, that also is going to stand in the way of building relationships, is it not?
Right. That's very true.
Yeah. And you know, I don't think people understand how common depression is among so many people in our communities. What effect did it have on you when you were in high school?
I was very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I would cling to people, like friendships. And then I would end up pushing people away because I would either try to get them as close as I could, or I would push them away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that affected all of my relationships, both friends and significant others. And I learned later when I was in college that because I had lost both caregivers at the same time, I gained what is called an attachment injury.
Mm.
And so basically I'm constantly afraid that everyone's going to be here 1 minute and then gone the next. And I've learned to call it my anxiety monster, because I'll start to get very, very afraid that people will just leave me. And I'm constantly worrying about that. And sometimes my anxiety monster will take over my whole life, and it makes it very difficult to lead a normal, quote unquote, life when you feel like you've got this other person inside of you that will come out and take over.
So
I struggle with that every day. It's almost like another full-time job.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Have you been continuously seeing a therapist all of this time, or have you, you know, is that gone by the wayside?
I stopped in my childhood. I stopped seeing a therapist. In high school, I would see, like, the guidance counselor. And then when I was in college, I really started to, like, seek out professional help.
Mm-hmm.
Some counselors were really helpful and others were not. There's, when I started working full-time after I graduated college, there's a program called the Employee Assistance Program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really nice program. It allows people who work full-time to seek out, like, professional counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So I utilize that through my employer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's excellent. There are so many, or more, employers now than ever that are offering that kind of assistance. So yeah, that's really, really valuable. But you know, there was, I don't know if you heard, there was a young man, 19 years old, in Champaign-Urbana yesterday who committed suicide because of depression.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It is so common that people just don't realize. And everybody, I think, has to some degree depression. It's just that some people might experience it to a greater level or for longer periods of time than others. But it's not an uncommon thing. And I know that there are, I don't know if you have any statistics, but many, many people who suffer this continual depression or, you know, bipolar disorder, any kind of mental illness, frequently they may not commit suicide, but they certainly oftentimes consider it.
Yes, and I really agree with that statement. I was there myself.
So what turned you around? How did you decide to go on and fight the battle against, you know, the mental health issue of depression?
Well, I guess just knowing, like, I had support from the friends that I have made. They're supportive of my mental illness. My family is sometimes supportive. They're not completely supportive of like medications I take, but I know that they still care about me.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps. Just finding, like, meaning and purpose in life, either through a job, or I really like to dance. I try to get involved in the community, just different things to keep me going.
Yeah. Well, you obviously successfully got through college and are working full time now. What field are you in?
Well, I got my degree. I went to Richland Community College for 2 years because it was the cheapest route.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought I wanted to pursue a degree from Lincoln Christian University, but I didn't like it at that school. So I transferred again to Millikan University, where I obtained my bachelor's in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been drawn to the mental health field. I wish I would have gotten my degree in human services, but at the time, psychology was the best fit because it's more of a broad. But I realized that psychology is more research-based, and I like being more helper-based.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's never too late.
Yeah.
Something to look at in the future.
I might go back to get my master's, maybe in, like, counseling or social work. I'm still not sure what I want to do. I currently work at Heritage Behavioral Health Center.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a recovery support specialist, or our title is also called peer support specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up gaining certification through the state of Illinois, so I'm now a certified recovery support specialist. And basically, we offer support and like assistance to people who have mental illness, and we like offer assistance on their level. So we get to tell, like, share our stories and our message of hope and our shared experience, like it lived that we've lived mm-hmm. in our everyday work. So it's a cool position to work as a peer to other people with mental illness, because we can say, like, I can personally say I've lived with depression and I know what it's like to have anxiety. And then other people can say, like, I know what it's like to have bipolar or schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really unique position.
And it sounds like that. So valuable. I mean, I know as a mom of a daughter with a developmental disability, how much comfort and support I found from being around other people who were experiencing the same thing that I did.
Yes. And it almost helps. It helps the staff too. Like, we become like a big family.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's support from both sides, which is very helpful to, like, overall.
Is this kind of position common in facilities around the state? Is this a therapy kind of a organization, Heritage, or is it a residential program? What kind of program is it?
Heritage has, they kind of do it all.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a behavioral health center, but they offer, like, help for people who are going through, like, detox or rehab from substance abuse. They have a floor that helps children who have mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
They have off-site programs like their group homes that are residential.
So is it common to have people in these types of programs? Is it common to have mental health recovery people like yourself, or is that something that's relatively new?
It's very new. Our program was a grant that got started from the William versus Quinn lawsuit. The place where I work is called the Wellness Recovery Drop-In Center. And so they, from the grant, they wanted us to create a drop-in center that would be a place for people to go that have lived in mentally ill nursing home
mm-hmm.
type places.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have those people who are coming out, because a lot of times they didn't have to, like, die in these nursing homes. They could function in society, but people just kind of shoved them in the nursing homes and forgot about them.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to get them out of the nursing home and back into society. And then where I work as a peer support specialist is at a drop-in center. And so the people who are coming out of those nursing homes will have a place to go that's a positive place for support. And then we're also allowed to have Heritage clients come in. And I know that it's been, like, it kind of was around years ago, and it's coming back, like the recovery movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's so needed. I mean, there's been this big push, I know, in the Champaign-Urbana area about, you know, the stigma related to mental health and you know, all the conditions that people struggle with. And the stigma, I mean, I'm so grateful to you and for others who have come on the show to tell your stories, because I think that hearing the story and hearing your voice helps people understand that you're really no different from them, and that people with mental health challenges are no different from anybody that they know in their lives. So thank you so much for doing that. We only have like a few seconds left, but is there any message that you would like to give the listeners about, you know, something that's important, something that you would like to say about your experience in your life?
I guess I just want to let people know that there might not be like a magic pill that can cure everything, but there is still like a light at the end of the tunnel. I've been in the darkest place before, and it seemed like there was no hope, but I kind of just had to take it one step at a time. And now that I am in recovery and I focus on my mental health every day, there's things I have to do every day to keep myself well. And I've realized not every day is going to be roses and butterflies. Some days are going to be really dark, but I wait for that next day where I do have the roses and butterflies. I recognize that recovery is an ongoing journey, and it's just important to kind of look at the bigger picture instead of focusing on just all the negatives that come up.
Thanks for joining me today, Sarah Lee, mental health recovery advocate.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. If you have not yet contributed to the WEFT Winter Appeal, if you didn't get your letter, it's still perfectly fine to go to our website and just click the Donate Now button at weft.org and support your local community radio. WEFT is a jewel in this community. Not many people have community radio stations that are accessible to the public. So if you make a donation, know that it will be money well spent. We don't have any wasteful spending at all around here. So most all the work is done by volunteers. We do have a part-time station manager, but that's a pretty new addition in the last few years. So make your donation. And thanks to those of you who have. We got a number of donations in this week. We really appreciate every dollar that people donate to us. Also, another way that you can donate is if you have an old car, a truck, a motorcycle, or some kind of vehicle that you'd like to get rid of, you can donate that to Charitable Adult Rides and Services and designate WEFT to receive the proceeds from your gift. All you need to have is a clear title. Charitable Adult Rides and Services will pick it up and haul it away with no charge to you. It's easy to make arrangements on their website. The website is careasy.com, or if you'd rather, you can call them at 855-500-RIDE. That's 855-500-7433. Just remember, you need to tell them that you want WEFT to receive the proceeds for your donation. And thank you in advance for your help. We're going to be going to Food Sleuth Radio in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth And today I'm honored to welcome my guest, Mr. Douglas Crabtree. He is the owner and operator with his wife, Dr. Anna Jones Crabtree, of Velikas Farms and Institute north of Havre, Montana, just a few miles